especially if our travel affairs will not be covered. This is 1 a.m. on December 18th, 2021, and do this for 6. I would like to call on our representative of the vice chair, Representative Falk, and myself, Representative Zolak Kishner. The quarter of last month, we are going to conduct an address for those in the room to see the same defendants or cell phones for the duration of the meeting. For those attending remotely, please mute yourself if you are here speaking. Before we begin, I would like to thank the employer of House Travel Affairs, Secretary for Records, and Kelsey Riker for the Toronto Office of Staffing Committee today. Today, we will hear presentations from representatives of the U.S. Canadian Tribunal. From representatives of the U.S. Canadian Tribal Health Consortium, Northern Health Corporation, the Yukon Pacific Health Corporation, Southeast Alaska Regional Health Consortium, and the Individual Service on the Role of Tribal Health Organizations in the state's COVID-19 response. We will be hearing by interviews from Dr. Bob Rogers from the U.S. Canadian Tribal Health Consortium, and I would like to welcome the director of that representative to our is online with us this morning. Dr. Rogers, you can begin by introducing yourself for the record and giving your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can you hear me fine?
You sound great.
Thank you. From Bob Rogers, physician at Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium, currently serving in the role of Alaska Native Medical Center Administrator.
Not only for COVID, but I'll present on the next slide, but related to
physicians, nurses, others from the different communities start saying things and then make an excitement out of childhood COVID, which stuff goes and then that time took for the COVID engagements after meeting with the world, maybe probably at the end of the season, dedicated to COVID patients, we had to open up an alternate care site. And at alternate care site, we were very fortunate at critical times to get staffing community health service, working with the VA as well as the state of Alaska, because I think without that, we would have had to close for transfers earlier than we would have had otherwise. So it was critical for us that we able to open that alternate care site and have staffing for NHS to help us do that at a critical time. Because, and I think, I know many of the regional partners of ANTC will be speaking after me, there's a significant difference when the hospitals close or any bridge. There were times before where all three hospitals were closed. And that occurs for the critical care patients, primarily critical care, but also having them seen for adult patients. And we're full. The ambulance is in Cambridge, they rotate around between the three hospitals. But where the challenge comes is when care transfers coming in from the regions. And then we need to try to prioritize, but when we're full, and it's, we can't stop the ambulance coming in, we'll deal with those patients in the emergency room, but it becomes a real challenge when the regions can't do their transfers and that occurred in the fall. What it proved is, I think, from my standpoint, is lack a lot of redundancy in Alaska with the health systems, whether that's with the clinical care physicians, or clinical care nurses, or just the clinical staff on the loan. We don't have a lot of redundancy to move people in different locations or build that significantly. And that is, from my standpoint, with this pandemic or in future issues, prevention is key. The mitigation measures that work, we need to keep those loans down so that we don't have to overwhelm our current system. One of the things that we're in right now with the vaccine and outpatient, I think, is potentially the most beneficial phase now. And I think a critical component of that has been what's called the self-immunization supplement. So in the health service with the government relationship with tribes in Alaska, we're able to get tribal health organizations additional vaccine on top of the state per capita allocation. Those numbers of vaccines significantly improved the vaccination effort across the state. It's an allocation similar to the Department of Defense as well as the Veterans Administration allocations. I think in all those areas, made new vaccines available earlier in Alaska. Also, I think tribal health organizations had a degree of flexibility to prioritize based on local priorities and get your vaccine out. The recent study at the Urban Institute said one of the key factors in giving vaccine to people and mitigating vaccine hesitancy is an established relationship with primary care providers and healthcare organizations. And I think that's one thing the tribal health system across the state of Alaska has. It has established relationships with its patients. It knows who may be the highest at risk because there are some electronic health records. Has appropriate contact information, is able to rule out to the most vulnerable populations quickly because of those established relationships. Everyone, I think, looks at Alaska differently in different areas of expertise, and I think what Alaska is doing from the tribal health system organization, you can look at Alaska based on the different tribal health organizations across the state. There's 27 different tribal health organizations, 12 major tribal health regions across the state. And so, from our standpoint, with the vaccine allocation, it's working with all these tribal health organizations across the state in order to get vaccine where it's most needed. And now that kind of the early period of scarcity with vaccine, and we're getting more vaccine, I think within the tribal health system, we've seen different areas where have been more successful in getting vaccine out in areas that are maybe a little bit more challenged. And some of that challenge is just related to the population and the dynamics related to that and the different types of populations in those regions. But I think now we're starting to see tribal health organizations and now the vaccines helps the different tribal health organizations to get some areas of movement. Because what GMCHC could be sort of looking at the vaccine data a little bit differently to try to help the vaccines in the areas that they have more need. Recently, Dr. Fauci is starting to be speaking at a retreat for what they have seen with their vaccine. And that was able to be moved out to the Division of Rural Association of Eastern Region Tribes. And what we're seeing with our challenges with lower vaccine availability for their population in those regions. And I think that's, to me, is kind of one of the key components in the tribal health response is that they definitely lose that with an infectious disease like COVID-19, we have to protect everyone in the community, not just tribal members. In order to make these fine, it's going to have to be everyone in that community to get those rates higher. It's fine on the 5-9, I mean, with the 5-9.
On the 5-9, I do have a question. I mean, I asked this question in the Health and Social Services Budget Subcommittee presentation yesterday, a week before our meetings, and Dr. Meek didn't have the information immediately available. Sense of the total number of vaccine allocation doses that have been made possible through this collaboration agreement that has been implemented throughout the state.
Supplement vaccine really helped that occur. Now, that's currently decided whether there's no result in equitable outcomes for the last 10 people across the state. And I think this is really a good sign that we're seeing a more proportional case counts based on race than we saw earlier for the last 10 people. But the last slide I have here, it's slide 11. It's morbidity and mortality weekly report, which just came out yesterday. And we're looking at vaccine administration. I apologize for the busyness, specifically in global states and programs. But the key portion, and this is a very rough last event, number two, in giving vaccine to communities most at risk. So those communities that have a high social vulnerability score. And social vulnerability includes income levels, age of patients, different variables that are measured in order to determine social vulnerability, and they do this across the United States, and they're looking at, how is vaccine allocation, because we like to do it to those communities most at risk. And Alaska is being a good job doing that. And I think this again goes back to the self-relation vaccine supplement, how that's being given. And if you look at the top three states, Montana, Alaska, and Arizona. While the article doesn't comment on the tribal allocation, many states, I think the tribal allocation of vaccine is a big thing in impacting not getting into those communities that are most at risk of complications during the program. And so with that, I'm done with my presentation. I'm happy to take any questions.
Was managing a very serious tuberculosis outbreak and we did not have a
pricing in this program to be an essential component of our response. We developed and expanded our telehealth capability to serve our communities. This is still widespread use today. This is given our limited flight availability. We are still using telehealth very, very extensively. And we set up widespread testing. So we set up testing that was a drive-through walk-in testing at the high school parking lot. We started meeting every flight that landed in our region. In Bethel, Antioch, and St. Mary's to offer testing. And then we began widespread testing in Millibus at positive patients. By the end of July, we had over 7,000 tests performed, and we had identified 42,000 cases total. We developed a rapid response team to travel the villages that did have positive cases to assist in treatment and testing. We were able to get less revenues within 20 hours of a positive result. Next slide, please. When we started, we had four, and then we added a fifth one shortly thereafter. We had repurposed individuals for Office of Environmental Health and Engineering. And so that, as the pandemic advanced, we increased that number greatly. As you'll see, as our cases started to rise in October, November, we went up to about 12 contact cases. Between September and December, so this is when we are really in the height of our outbreak. We had weekly meetings with multiple stakeholders in our region, tribal city governments, school districts, individual villages, and internal rec agency staff to keep everyone informed and updated, and to talk to individual villages that have outbreaks to talk about mitigation strategies. We continued our village trips for testing consisting of positive patients. As of March of 2021, we have performed approximately 74,600 tests. And by the end of December, we had over 3,600 for total cases in our region. We're averaging between 50 and 100 new cases a day, and a peak of 145 cases in one day occurred in November. Next slide, please. Vaccination and pandemic management. That's questions became available in the summer, and I cannot say enough about the availability of the Pediatric Health Service vaccine. I can see some of us on the line have been so sick to our partners, and it is not too big of an exaggeration to say that both state lives having access to this Pediatric Health Service allocation of vaccinations. We set up a distribution plan to get to all 47 of our villages. At the beginning of the event today, about 30 villages in 4 days with multiple teams to administer vaccines and healthcare workers. We then quickly expanded our allocation to the older population to start running into this effort because we realized almost right away that we had to vaccinate for an older village to start our pandemic under control. And it is heavy lifting at the villages, so expanding eligibility almost right away is the plan that best could manage that. Next slide, please. So between December 18th and January 9th, we completed 57 individual village visits throughout the Delta. We visited all of the villages, and we many received multiple visits, so we started at a 3- or 4-week interval where we would get the first shot and then come back 3 or 4 weeks later to check if they were a Pfizer village or a Moderna village, and then the second shot plus vaccinating people. We set up a large area in Bethel in the hospital to vaccinate Bethel-based individuals and healthcare providers. Next slide, please. Our vaccination status as of March 17th, we have identified a little over 20,000 eligible patients, so those in our region who are aged 16 and older. 53.2% have received at least one dose, and 43.8% have received both doses. Next slide, please. Our future efforts have been continuing. Yes?
Sorry. Just to keep jumping in and asking questions. Can you talk on this slide about the status of the percent of individuals in the region who have received vaccinations? Can you talk about how quickly your region was able to expand vaccinations at these tribal health facilities to non-tribal health beneficiaries?
Yes, that's an excellent point. I think Dr. Evers also brought this up right away. We basically, for the first wave, the one mandation for the wave was really indicated for healthcare workers, healthcare residents, and perhaps a lot of the beneficiaries as well. So that was vaccinated. But we did a deep research, and we realized that we really needed to vaccinate everyone who lives in the communities. Especially our fragile elders, regardless of their insurance status. So we, by December 23rd, I remember beginning, right before Christmas, we opened up vaccinations to those aged 65 and older in villages and in Buffalo. So then we kind of pivoted in mid-January offering that to all residents, regardless of age or medical condition, as a way of helping get our pandemic under control. And if you look at I think it's back on the slide when we talk about this, slide number 5. You can see that those results in a very precipitous drop in our rates. If you look at the numbers between January and February, we had 1,018 in January and 252. Now, there were probably multiple things that came into play there, but that vaccination rate is a huge part of that enormous drop right there.
Hindsight is always 2020, but I'm sure that, the preference would have been there people in that category where you had this broad response, you know, prevention from life, mitigation, overall for positivity rate, et cetera. Has there been an assessment as to how a little particular, really effective drug was it like the population not following through with medication, standard mitigation?
That's a great question. We spent a lot of time thinking about it, and obviously trying to prevent it. We're still having outbreaks. We're still, we have 3 different villages right now with significant outbreaks. It's my opinion that you limit to 3 or 4 different factors. The first is crowded open county small homes with poor ventilation. So it's very difficult if you have a home of between 18 and 21 people to not get
isolate in villages of limited housing. So that's probably another one factor. In fact, I just had a positive yesterday in a household of 21 individuals, and there were that many people in that home that had died because of a house fire, and they combined to our three different households. So I think adding both individual homes. The second is lack of access to adequate sanitation. 60% of the homes in our region do not have access to running water or sewer. We know from previous studies done in our region that this increases the rate and severity of respiratory illness. So those two factors play heavily into that. And lastly, I think it's some infrastructure issues that come into play with regards to housing and access to medical care and all those kinds of things that play into regions such as ours with those kinds of issues.
Some of those seem to be pretty embedded and difficult problems to overcome in terms of, I think as much as we possibly can, both the state and the federal and others, to need assistance to, cause a shift in it. These are deep problems, and it's not something that, can easily be addressed, certainly in a shorter amount of time. But I think that's with the red light coming up here in terms of, probably long after we get through this particular virus and this particular pandemic, we need to remember that in order to prevent this kind of thing from happening again, we need to start
our future efforts to looking at vaccine distribution for a we're going to continue our vaccine distribution in our villages, utilizing both health beds and visiting providers. So how it works, as I mentioned earlier now, is that we just continue that after we end up going out to villages. We have to be just as with our favorite parts. I have a few villages that I've been returning to regularly over the past few weeks to go deliver vaccine. And every time we go, we're able to vaccinate more and more people as confidence rises in vaccinations in our region. And some of our villages are similar to our overall population of eligible people is 53.2%. Some of our villages have achieved well over 95% of our eligible population vaccinated. And I cannot say enough as a student work on our community confidence and providers in getting that up to that higher number. Slide 10, please. Our future efforts are like using routine village visits by providers as often as possible for medical, dental, and vision appointments. And continue to provide public information on the status of the virus in our region. And respectfully request the Alaska legislature to pass House Bill 76 for the authorization of the emergency, the public health emergency. This will allow us to continue to build for telehealth services, which are absolutely essential, especially in light of our decreased ability to transfer patients by air. Business certainly after the pandemic started, and this is a curtail our ability for patients to fly and come to in-person appointments. And then, of course, the risk of travel for individuals at the time before vaccinations were readily available, and that was also quite high. So, telehealth has been essential. And again, thankful to the Alaska Medical Center and the Alaska Telehealth Consortium for stepping up and really increasing their telehealth capabilities so that our patients can even access them. Highly specialized care at home in their own village. Next slide, please. And this is just some resources for you. If you're interested, we have the Start Resource page and then we publish a weekly situation report on the website. And then for communities with a great qualified vaccination data, we have the percent of eligible individuals for vaccine for vaccination on that page as well. And then for providers, we have a digital. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just wondering, so before the pandemic, we had a pretty strong telehealth system, as my understanding, especially in tribal healthcare. And then we have expanded those services and coverage of services through having a public health emergency declaration. I guess that we're in this weird gray period where we don't have a lot of time to get So then, at the point where that goes away in the future, should we be thinking about how to have permanency for those expanded telehealth services, or are they not as necessary once, you know, travel can be resumed? Are we learning any lessons about that in terms of effectiveness in delivery of services? Does it help? Should we be thinking about, you know, long-term opportunities?
Thank you.
Can you talk about the risk of having any vaccination rates or high transmission rates and what that means for the folks in the state getting around and making people travel. How is that a danger folks in the rest of the state?
Responding to the pandemic from the villages who are COVID
Yeah.
if there's an opportunity to do so. Thank you so much, Dr. Hodges and Jen, for the presentation this morning. Please feel free to stay on the line for additional questions that come forward for the variations in the meeting. Next up, we will hear from Evangeline Dorman, the Alaska Area Director for the Indian Health Service. Ms. Dorman, if you could begin by introducing yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Evangeline Angel Dorman. I serve as the Indian Health Service Alaska Area Director. In fact, I've been serving as the Area Director for 2.5 weeks, longer than a year. So I serve as Area Director just as a permanent sitting. Madam Chair and committee members, thank you for the opportunity to share with you the Indian Health Service COVID-19 pandemic response and support actions in the Alaska area. The federal government has worked closely with state, local, tribal, and territorial partners, as well as public health partners, to respond to this public health threat. The Alaska area specifically has worked to provide our tribal partners with support however possible, including funding, testing supplies, procurement PPE, personal protective equipment, and general advocacy. In fiscal year 2020, the Alaska area made a health service discovery that $161,040,409 to our tribal health partners from the CARES Act and other pandemic supplemental funding. For the Indian Health Service and Health Supply Service Center, we were also able to distribute personal protective equipment such as gowns, gloves, masks, and many other needed supplies. To assist with COVID-19 testing in rural areas, the Indian Health Service also distributed 47 Abbott ID analyzers, over 200,000 Abbott ID tests, and approximately 25,360 Abbott BIDAS tests. This doesn't include other types of testing options that we've had. We've been able to assess with some survey tests directly through a separate contract. To assist with staffing limitations, the Indian Health Service also worked with multiple agencies to deploy Commission Corps officers to assist our tribal partners with critical healthcare staffing shortages. And to assist with COVID-19 vaccine preparation, the Indian Health Service conducted extensive data collection early on to assist the Centers for Disease Control and the Federal Vaccine Response Operations with estimating vaccine needs within the Alaska tribal health system. In addition, I just advocated strongly for fair distribution of vaccine to all of our tribal partners, regardless of their selection of vaccine jurisdiction. And the main reason for that is in Alaska, all of our Alaska tribes chose to utilize the state of Alaska for their vaccine jurisdiction. Finally, I'm thankful that the Alaska Indian Health Service and the Indian Health Service have played an active role in this pandemic response. In addition, I'm grateful that the Alaska Tribal Health System of Tribal Health Organizations has continued to show how innovative, effective, and efficient it is at delivering needed healthcare in most remote locations under adverse conditions. I'm proud that we're partners not only in this pandemic response, but also in the delivery of healthcare in Alaska in general for all NGS beneficiaries. And Madam Chair, I'll stand for any further questions the committee may have.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You made the comment about all of the tribes chose to use Alaska for their jurisdiction. I didn't quite understand what that meant in terms of vaccine distribution.
Okay, for the chair. Within all tribes across the nation have the option to select either their state for vaccine jurisdiction or the Indian Health Service. And it was totally the tribe's choice how they went through that process. In Alaska, we've got a very a long-standing vaccine process that our tribal health system in the state of Alaska has perfected over many years. And this option for jurisdiction for the Indian Health Service was the first time that we had ever had the opportunity to do so. we knew that data management was going to be very difficult. Partners in rural Alaska were probably the ones who had the most difficulty, especially because most of our tribal partners in Alaska have chosen that are running commercial off-the-shelf electronic health records, which would have been more difficult to report into the IHS reporting system. So that has been the main focus and one of the main topics of discussion as vaccine jurisdiction selection was occurring.
Any other additional questions at this time? Seeing none, thank you so much, Dr. Darling. We would love if you could stand in the line if there are any additional questions. I do know that the dissemination of COVID-19 now, particularly early in the pandemic, was so critical as that stood up your capacity for higher throughput testing in terms of identifying cases early on before outbreaks, widespread outbreaks could occur. So, really appreciate the advocacy and work of the Indian Health Service on that front and the continued championing of vaccination on the table. As Dr. Albers mentioned, the disproportionate investment to help prevent it. So thank you so much, and please join me if you're able. Next, we will hear from Dr. Mark Peterson from the Martin Field Health Corporation. Dr. Peterson, please introduce yourself for the record and begin your presentation.
Hello, I'm Dr. Mark Peterson. I'm the director of Martin Sound Health Corporation in Lane, Texas. And thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate the opportunity to come and speak and talk and tell you about our story. I do want to take this opportunity, any opportunity I have to thank people. I won't be able to do that. I want to thank ANC and ANTHC and Dr. Auger's for their efforts. You'll see that their efforts helped us considerably. I also am thankful for the collaboration that we have throughout the state with the tribal health organizations. We meet regularly. That collaboration has been very important to us and our success here. YKHC, Dr. Ellen Hodges, our collaboration has been very helpful. And we certainly appreciate everything that the state is doing and our federal contingents as well. We are about a third of the size of YKHC. We're about a little under 10,000 people. We have had some success in our mitigation strategy. I want to talk about that a little bit, why we've had some success, what are things that have worked for us, because I think it's helpful to see how that's worked for us and to answer some of the questions, you know, why it's worked. Our story, of course, is very similar to all the other tribal health organizations. A lot of what Dr. Hodges said, you know, we have a similar story and similar timeline. We knew initially when this pandemic broke a year ago that we had to have a very aggressive prevention strategy. You know, we're a little smaller. We knew we could not handle large numbers of cases. We knew we had to prevent this virus from getting in, or at least delay it as long as possible until we could set up a good structure of good incident command team, good testing, quarantine, et cetera. We have elders in our region who still recall stories from their parents and grandparents about the Spanish flu, and like a lot of communities in the state, many of our villages were wiped out from the Spanish flu. And the people in our region, you know, have a real fear of pandemics, a healthy fear. But I'm very thankful for the collaboration that we have in the state. Again, our strategy from the very beginning has been aggressive prevention and mitigation strategy. We just don't have the infrastructure to be able to handle large number of cases. When the pandemic first broke for us, we really did shut down significantly. We shut down the city of Rome, all of our villages shut down for very, very limited air travel. And we did that to try to prevent folks from coming in. We set up an aggressive testing program and aggressive quarantine program. We We're very thankful that AMC had large capacity testing equipment that they procured from the very beginning. I mean, I can recall specific telephone calls about when they got these units. That was really life-saving for us. And they were thankful to be able to hold off the virus until they developed a good testing strategy where we could test them around all of our folks and send those test reps into UNC to get testing done. They've been around talking about the outright now testing units. Distribution of virus, about ANC's distribution of virus, those were critical for us. Early on, we decided that we would put a gravid ID now in every single village. We have 15 villages, IT has 50 plus villages. So we were at an advantage, and we wanted to aggressively get gravid ID now analyzers, put them in every village, and put them in now in our lab. We looked, of course, for large capacity testing units. Didn't get one. We just got one now. We're just putting it in our Roche COVAX unit. You know, it's taken a year for us to get it. We're putting it in now. But we, AMC was making critical, and that brand was critical in helping us procure our brand new analyzers. But from the peak of our testing program, we were running seven of those brand new analyzers in our lab. Sort of running flat. And then slowly getting right out to each and every village and then training all the staff out there to run those. So that was critical for us. We had adequate quarantine programs for the city of Blount, and each village had those as well. We did aggressive testing of our staff and very aggressive weekly testing. Certainly our nursing home staff and residents were tested aggressively, and the village staff as well. And then around the education of those into training and so on. Health aides did impressive work in learning about COVID-19 and taking care of that for us in the villages. We have three public health nurses that did a lot of our contract tracing initially. We were able to hold off for us for quite a while. But similar to Whitegate's team, we had developed our own contract tracing team. That became critical for us. Later on, we did that pretty early on. We followed suit quite a bit later, and it happened when the state started getting overwhelmed with cases. The state public health nurses could no longer really accommodate us. It became essential for us to develop our own contact tracing team. So we essentially found a team of six contact tracers. They still work with us day and night. I mean, they're part of our team here. So that was essential as well. We set up an incident command structure that we met very regularly. The other thing that we did is we set up an 11 a.m. regional call to any resident of the region daily. It's usually Monday through Friday, now it's Monday through Thursday, and we've run that for a full year now. That was essential for getting information out, getting education out, and letting people know what was going on, what was real, what was not, what's false information. That was extremely helpful for us as well. If you could go to slide two there, so this is our dashboard as of last Monday. Now again, we're a rate of about 10,000, but you see the total number of tests completed, almost 67,000. That really is a large number. The vast majority of those were done on our average IDNOW analyzers. And people will sometimes speak poorly of the operating house, but they really stand by reads it really good. Certainly early on, we used testing equipment at UNC, which was central, but then we shifted to, you really want to be able to do your own tests, get your results right away, and get people into isolation right away. And so getting these analyzers was the right thing for us to do. You can see the large number of tests we got, and unique patients tested is about 12,000. So those 67,000 tests were on 12,000 people. So essentially, you're almost testing every person in the region 6 times during the course of this pandemic. We have, to this day, had a total of 324 positive cases. teams out to take care of that. So it's not that we haven't had outbreaks. We had outbreaks, but by the time we had our outbreaks, we had testing equipment, we had contact tracing teams, we were able to fly out additional analyzers and reverse testing. It really does work to do all that. We're thankful that we could hold virus off to get things in place. We've had a total of 6 hospitalizations to this point, thankfully, no deaths. So now we're out of tests on the vaccine strategy. Again, that's the life-saving measure. We waited up for that, could not wait until it was distributed. And very, very thankful for, again, that combination of state allocation and IHS distribution. No question that that has helped us tremendously. If you want to go to the next slide, let me talk to my last slide. This is a summary of our vaccination percentages as of this past Monday. Getting the first half of our population vaccinated was not that difficult. I mean, it wasn't easy. We as well, some of the IK, teams going out to the villages, airplanes going out, carrying vaccine out. Half of our population very excited about getting vaccinated. We had no trouble getting to that. For 50% of our eligible population, the next half is going to be a little bit more difficult. But we have pretty good numbers. You know, you can see on here, first doses given, or percent of population greater than 16 who received the first dose, so sort of at the middle right of the spreadsheet there. And you can see the vast majority of our villages are well over 50% of eligible population vaccinated with the first dose. The white belt is 89%, several in the 70% range, and those with the difficult. For Nome itself, 67% of our eligible population vaccinated, and for the entire region, 63% eligible who have been vaccinated. And that comes to about 50% of our entire population vaccinated. We know we need to try to get to about 80%, so we've got 40% yet. To go, that's still an uphill battle. We know we're going to need a childhood vaccine coming up. We hope to have it happen in the next couple of months. Once we get crowded up vaccine, that'll be another big percentage of our region that can get vaccinated. So we continue to push vaccination. Johnson's been very helpful. A lot of people have been excited about that window still done. You know, we're not letting up. We're easing up a little bit on testing now that we know that the vaccines are very effective for asymptomatic infection. We know that they're effective now. We can start easing off on testing of people who are fully vaccinated. We'll slowly pull that back and then put our efforts into continuing to vaccinate people. I wanted to touch on a couple of things because there were quite a few questions about the testing question. Certainly the collaboration we've had, the large department. show. I will agree with Dr. Fogg. He's completely on telehealth. It was essential to us. The ability to meet with patients simply by cell phone at the home for our behavioral health team, our primary care team, that's been essential. We would like to continue that and expand in telehealth services for as long as possible. That's been essential. The vaccination distribution system has been essential. I talked on that. And then having our own contact tracers as well has been essential. But, you know, we're not going to let up. And as we don't know, like Dr. Roberts said, we don't know where the end is for this. We do know that getting everybody vaccinated is critical. Our group that needs it, it's not for the core group of very educated reasons for reading. I will tell you what they're worried about is we've looked at the cases across the state, and they are worried about the rally and the large numbers of cases there. You know, there's about to say basketball tournament that's going on, and that region has a big concern about our basketball students going and playing basketball in the rally and coming back. So the state's a big concern as well as that as well. And we are watching those numbers. We do want to make sure for the entire state to get vaccinated. It is so important. And now, lessening resistance to the vaccine is key. It's key for us. I think it's key for the whole state. But it's essential to getting the vaccines by now. Thank you.
Thank you, Matthew. I'm very happy to hear you bring up the three positive deployment. That's something I'm pretty passionate about on the former Buffalo Pioneer, and I'm going to be sharing some information with my fellow colleagues about this. I'm going to talk about the NSAA. You know, they have put in place, they canceled the state tournament last year, put in, you know, protocols about all this stuff. They have chosen the highest rate of COVID in the state to host the basketball tournament. And it absolutely makes no sense to me to do what they're doing. So, I'm going to make a phone call to SWA today, and I will share that information with all our fellow legislators here to possibly call them. And I think this suggests we've done such a good job in our rural areas of trying to protect the old areas from getting COVID and stuff. And now we're actually promoting bringing all these kids and people in to the spot right now that is the hot spot. And I just don't see any logic in what they're doing. So thank you for bringing that up. That's not what we're working on today, so thank you.
Yeah, to the chair, if I may, I appreciate those comments. We did have Bobby Strickland, the director of the SAA, come on to our regional call. And our residents let him know they were happy that there's not rapid testing available at the tournament. They were happy with that. So I would agree with that. And they're not happy that it's in the valley where high case rates are happening. Now, if you've been in Florida, certainly regional schools don't, they're not required to participate, but the kids can participate. So the deficiencies we saw were the lack of localized testing, the rapid testing there. But thank you for your comments.
Yeah, thank you. And it simply doesn't make any sense, you know, from what he's saying. They're running a double standard at this point. You know, they're not looking at mixed place for us to get things in. There are, you know, alternatives, like, you know, we could host the 3-8 tournament at Mount Edgecombe, the 4-8 tournament in Juneau, or Fairbanks, where the rates are extremely low. And the option is here, you know, let's get in the because basically Anchorage is what's important, and it's about money, not our kids. And that's what really concerns me, because I was a former athlete, and this is no longer about what's best for kids, it's about what's best for the entity, and saving a few bucks. And I'm not about saving a few bucks for my kids, you know, I'm looking out for the best for all of our student athletes. So, anyway, I'll be working on that today. Thank you.
Thank you.
I much appreciate your comments and time from Dr. Peterson before, and I can go and send you a question on it. can you talk about, you know, when you began vaccinations to how quickly you were able to make decisions to expand that eligibility more broadly in some of those initial and early ways, and where did it stand right now?
Yeah, thanks for that question. And, you know, Russ didn't address that, so I'm glad that you brought that up. But our timeline, very similar to what DHC timeline, Dr. Hodges and I actually emailed a little bit on that. What we were seeing, so our timeline was almost not to the day, but to the week. So we expanded right away just as they did, because we saw that we had a good allocation. We got our 65 and older vaccinated, we got our nursing home residents vaccinated, we got all the harvest people vaccinated right away. We just didn't see a reason, with just 10,000 people in our region, we didn't see a reason to slowly go through the list of everybody else. It just didn't make sense. It's so difficult to get out to the villages. But we decided, almost simultaneously with them, that we're just going to open up our whole region. We were a little bit nervous about doing that because the state and Dr. Harris and I were both on the state committee working on how the state would roll out their allocation. And we were kind of doing our own thing. And we had the ability to do that with our NHS allocation. So I was a little bit nervous about doing it. What's the rest of the state going to think, et cetera? But we knew that it was the same thing. So right away in January, we did the same thing. We opened up everybody we had up and but I do like seeing that the state has gone to that as well. Anybody that lives or works in the state of Alaska is open for the vaccine. Once you get those highest-risk people vaccinated, I think it makes sense to open up to everyone. It's been effective for us. And now our challenge is we have plenty of vaccine. We need more people signing up more rapidly. So we're bringing back to our people wherever they are now. That's our next not just our pharmacy, that's where we currently get vaccines, but we're going to bring it to the airport at City Hall Tuesdays, Wednesdays, and Friday night, 6:30, 7:30, we have a vaccination clinic. We're going to start adding additional off-site locations with our community. And we're going to start going across the house of the villages, bringing Johnson & Johnson there. Anything that reduces the roadmap to getting vaccinated is going to be helpful. Believe it or not, even in a small village, it's a hassle for somebody to walk out of the clinic and get vaccinated. If you can walk it to their house and give it to them, we will get more people vaccinated that way. So that's kind of where we're at with our vaccination program now.
Thank you so much, Representative
Crump. Thank you, Andrew. And this is for anybody that's online here in what area is served by Kennewick Chiefs primarily. But I just want to thank you guys all for, you know, even though you guys are Native medical educators, my parents, you know, still live back in the Richmond area, and they have access to getting that shot. You know, so I just think it's great that if people are truly getting, you guys have given everyone an opportunity to be vaccinated. I really appreciate that, actually. And that is my question, is that we have the different, you know, girls, boys, and trans and family. Is there a preference for you guys, or does it
a great question, and the answer is the vaccine that's most available to you is the one that you should get. You really can't compare them head to head, but they're all tested at different times. The bottom line is they're all highly effective. We're all appreciative that we have three vaccines, and really what we tell people in our region is the vaccine that's most available to you that you can get today, that's the one to take. And I would not hesitate. I got Moderna myself. I would not hesitate to not take any E3. And so people should not worry about which vaccine to get. They really should not. They should just get the vaccine that's available to them most immediately.
And a great question that I was just chatting with one of the fellows that I mentioned is with a vaccine, does it help with after effects when getting COVID? Like myself, I'm COVID. If I have the vaccine, is there any scientific data that says it will help
nobody's really aware of how simple a disease can get. There's a large percentage of people that do go on to get chronic symptoms. So that's the reason to get vaccinated versus what we would tell you is, hey, I just get COVID because it's like the flu and you get over it and you'll be fine. That's no longer the case. You may go, even if you have mild disease or no symptoms, you may go on to have some chronic symptoms related to COVID. So that's the reason to get vaccinated. So to answer your question, I don't believe in vaccine has shown any efficacy in reducing, you know, chronic COVID symptoms, unfortunately.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Dr. Peterson, for joining us this morning. And please feel free to stay online if there are additional questions that come forward. Next, we will be hearing from Eric Evans and Dr. Elliot Gruhl from the Southeast Alaska Regional Health Consortium. Mr. Evans and Dr. Gruhl, please introduce yourselves for the record and begin your presentation.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Dr. Elliot Gruhl. I'm a family physician, chief medical officer for the Southeast Alaska Regional Health Consortium, and senior vice president.
Good morning. I'm Eric Dennis. I'm the vice president here for clinics and behavioral health at the Southeast Consortium. I'm Dr. Herman Chino. I think we're going to that'll start off our presentation today. Dr. Gruhl will lead us through that. Is there any way that we will be able to see the presentation ourselves, or do we kind of guess where the button is?
That's a great question. We're learning how to write on the screen as we go through the presentation. We'll be at the school system. So hopefully, trust us.
Thank you.
Okay, well, I'll do my best to try to see what's on your screen there. So, if you could go ahead and move to the next slide. So, search has really, in Southeast Alaska, has experienced many of the same challenges as the other regions that you've already heard from. The tapestry of care that exists in this region of the state is a little bit different. We provide care in 27 different locations, and in those locations, pre-pandemic, we've been providing care to all members of the communities, or committed to all members of the communities that we serve. The only exception to that being Juno, where our clinical outpatient services have been primarily focused on native beneficiaries. Next slide. This is a timeline that illustrates some of the events that occurred early on in the pandemic, and along with some of the other health leaders that you heard from this morning, Dr. Alvarez, Dr. Hodges, there's a recognition back in February that this was likely going to have an effect, and for search, the first thing that we did was to set up an incident command system that would allow us to create consistent communication with our employees and with outside agencies. And there were regular meetings on a weekly basis with IHS leadership regarding resources. It's kind of hard at this point in time to put our minds back to that time, but some of the main concerns that we were dealing with were personal protective equipment and navigating possible shortages of that nationally. And as the emergency operations centers were set up in communities as well as on a statewide basis, those became information nexus that allowed for communication about the availability of PPE, and we received PPE through national supply through the IHS, and also worked to receive PPE through other suppliers that we usually do. There was also kind of a bad rush around the country for ventilators, recognizing that this is a respiratory virus. We have many ventilators that we have in an emergency stockpile, but we placed orders for some additional ventilators early on, and eventually by midsummer weren't able to receive some additional ones. Some aspects of our response involved increased training for respiratory care, particularly related to remote sites and remote locations for our staff employed care in those locations, as well as distributing those ventilators. Another major part of the early response was gaining access to testing. We've already talked about AMNC's role in terms of the Abbott 99 rapid tests, and I cannot say how essential that was in terms of our early response, in terms of being able to respond in a timely way at all of our clinical locations. So you may remember that there were a number of sequential orders from the governor regarding the pandemic that involved changing the structure of the delivery of care, creating safe environments for surgeries and for other procedures and for caring for patients. And for months, we were really retooling our practice on a regular basis. Mr. Davis and I and our team were constantly creating new procedures for screening, coming into facilities for testing, and we ultimately went to testing every single person in our organization every week. That's no longer the case, but for many months it was. And also going through the process of standing up telehealth services. The telehealth services really saved our ability to maintain continuity of service with many of our patients, not just over distances, but even within communities, because as the pandemic built, there were more and more cases, and we saw in some of our larger communities, like Juneau and Sitka, at times there were as many as 5 to 10 new cases every day. This allowed for the safe engagement of patient care, and the strict screening of patients and staff before they came into facilities also contributed to that. I want to dovetail on some of the comments that have been made already this morning about telehealth, and just to say that while we have had the ability to do telehealth, and particularly have utilized the behavioral health realm and the delivery of services to smaller communities and villages, never have we been able to provide so much care in this manner. Never has our patient groups been so receptive to it. The availability of technology to patients is much more than it's ever been. And the ability to be able to bill for those services has been essential to our being able to services from Optavia staying, drawing care out of our health systems and into those types of services being provided from very remote locations. And that really has the potential to create a really corrosive effect on our systems. Because, you know, it's extremely expensive for us to provide services anywhere in the state, and to have those types of services coming from outside the state is a real concern. And I have expressed that concern to members of our state on the board. I express it to you, too.
There's a question Dr. Paul, our friend Lopez has a question.
Thank you. Several of the speakers before I met here spoke about the important role that telehealth has played in the ability for the state to prevent the virus, but also to extend health care services in other ways to our state residents. The question is there a direct connection? This question is for many of the people who are currently online that are previously testified. Do you see a connection between the continued ability of the state to deliver telehealth medical services and the extension of the emergency declaration, specifically titled as an emergency declaration? Is that an important element to have if we were to adopt, let's say, Hospital 76 without the title? Emergency declaration being a part of that piece of legislation, would that be problematic in terms of the ability for our residents to continue to receive telehealth services either within the state or outside of the state?
So I think Dr. Bull, you can begin by answering, and then I would like to offer the opportunity for anyone who's still on the line to be able to jump in. Dr. Bull.
Yes, there are very important elements of telehealth that involve providers outside the state. So we have specialist relationships that are existing for our patients with specialists in Seattle as well as in Anchorage, and telehealth has become a basis for the continuation of our care with the specialists, and the recent cancellation of the emergency orders did cut off the ability for those specialist relationships outside the state to be able to continue. I am aware of the fact that continuation of reimbursement for telehealth services is a state-by-state determination with regards to Medicaid, and we very, very strongly feel that, that the state of Alaska should continue that, because this is becoming an expectation of patients and clinicians in terms of their relationships. So I think the state should do everything it can to support that. The ability of that care to continue to be protected by our clinicians to our patients. My concern, as I stated earlier, is it's very disheartening to consider the idea that our patients in our communities will be drawn away into relationships with providers in very far away outside the state, who have no understanding of the unique determinants of health that may face in Alaska. So.
Thank you so much, Dr. Bull. I think that there are a couple of feedback on that list, but we have both Dr. Hodges and Dr. Peterson, and then Robert does open up to you. Dr. Hodges and then Dr. Peterson.
I think probably this
share what you're seeing outside of Ortiz, and I wonder also if maybe it's Dr. Brulee's work, you are concerned about expanding telehealth and the broad West nature that telehealth has somewhat become in the environment, and which from my perspective seems like having the flexibility to hold it through a disaster declaration, which is Hospital 76, provides the expansion supports that the health providers are looking for, but also provides finite sunset to those expansions so that the medical industry and medical professionals are safe and better teaches out any of the challenges related to the Wild West nature, if you will, of drawing away services from Alaska entities outside of the state. And that just seems to be maybe an associated question for our panel this morning, because is having a temporary measure such as a disaster declaration that affords those flexibilities that you need, but also ensures that there's a sunset date to those provisions to make sure that any permanent solutions for expanding telehealth protect the Alaska institutions.
Madam Chair, yes, absolutely. I think the emergency declaration has been essential to our being able to respond to the challenges of the crisis. It's been, and as Dr. Hodges points out, it has actually leapfrogged our ability to provide care to much needed care to our behavioral health patients in ways that have that have really impressed us, surprised us, startled us, and our patients, and how effective that's been. I think those of us who are in administrative roles in medical practice in the state also recognize that these rapid developments also create some vulnerabilities. And our patients, in some respects, deserve to have all the access that they can to care. However, I think there is a as leaders, we also need to be creating systems that are safe, and that are safe not only for patients, but also for the systems that we that we're responsible for shepherding and maintaining. If we are unable to maintain these systems because of the fact that predatory, I'm just going to assign some terms to it, predatory health systems are projecting opportunities for patients to go way, way outside of the state in receiving that care. There is a bit of some value in that, but in the long-term sense, it will be destructive to this, this wonderful system of healthcare that we have, the pandemic has shown we're able to, respond to a crisis like this in an effective way. And just undermine that infrastructure. So that there's got to be a balance there. I think what you just said touches on taking what we've learned from the pandemic and the emergency orders and coming to a legislative administrative structure that that supports the future.
Yeah, I'm sure I'm just trying to get an angle just trying to get an angle of how important it is. How important is this particular piece of legislation? How important is it that it includes the title of an emergency declaration? And what I thought is, as I shared in my last question, that if it does include that, are we then expecting providers, both within
another question about that item? Is that a question that you might be able to speak to?
This is Dr. Hedges. I'm going to take a quick stab at it. There's other elements besides healthcare. I come from a state in Quad City, and the emergency declaration was allowed our city council to do some things with report, asking, and testing, and that kind of thing, which is always helpful in a pandemic. And to me, I think the public health crisis of the time of the emergency declaration isn't over. I'm not religious right now with current active outbreaks, and I have. You know, I think something like close to 100 active cases in our region right now. We're not done yet. We're close, and we're getting there. I know everyone wants this to be over, but just not quite there yet. And I think the comment is saying that the emergency, quote unquote, emergency is over might send a wrong message to people. Although, to me, if we get all the elements that we need for the emergency public health declaration, the name of it doesn't really matter to me. And I do understand, of course, about political implications of that, but, you know, the public health crisis is over. It's just a fact. It's just a complete fact. And in fact, while we've been talking on this call, I've been receiving positive test results over my message system. So, I mean, it's just not over yet.
Okay, I do really recognize the time. We have about 10 minutes left in the hearing today. I want to make sure that we cover the high points of Serge's presentation. And we were just going over the COVID-19 timeline for the first part of 2020. So, Dr. Grola and Mr. Dykstra, I'll turn it back over to you.
Next slide. You'll see that by the fall, we were delving pretty deeply into our relationships with school districts and all of our areas and partnering with them and trying to come up with mitigation plans that reflected the safe school guidelines from the CDC, as well as dealing with local preferences and school boards. So Dr. Zink and the state medical leadership really did not determine that the best thing was for local communities to be able to make determinations that reflected the situation on the ground, which was appropriate, but created a tremendous need for input on those issues. If you go to the next slide, it presents some summary numbers for testing. We, as I said earlier, the pandemic relied very heavily on the out-and-out test kits, and as you heard from Ms. Bartabain and from Dr. Orders, they projected those out to us, and we in turn projected those out into many of our communities, and that really were the foundation of the initial our initial responsibility to create a safe response. And as I mentioned at the beginning, we provide care to everybody in the communities that we serve, and so really the entire region of the state benefited greatly from those resources. We subsequently went on to purchase an M2000 as well as a Cepheid Infinity. And you can see that, over, these are summary numbers, but over the course of the last year, we have performed over 107,000 tests. And, in some of our smaller communities, it's 800 to 1,000 tests, and our larger communities, over 50,000 tests. These numbers include also the tests that we perform on our staff. Next slide. In December we saw the arrival of the vaccine, and I guess what I'm most proud of our organization about is the intensity and dedication to which the vaccine distribution was attended. If you could go to the next slide, you'll see some pictures of some of our folks distributing vaccine all around the region. Mr. Dacus personally has ordered a vaccine at Wind Canal in the middle of a winter storm. You know, we flew a vaccine with float planes and other boat trips all around the region to make sure that we got it out. And I think that there's a really significant issue here, not only in terms of the medical, the paramedical needs of the communities, but also this really has given hope to people in our communities, and really at its very best, that's what medical care does. It gives people hope. Sometimes it cures disease, sometimes it doesn't, but if we can give people hope, then we're doing our job. And this was, you know, this was an extremely, given the history of the epidemics which devastated many communities in this area in the past century, this was a very significant event. Next slide. I think one of the big challenges has been scheduling and registering patients in the context of vaccine administration. And Mr. Dallas and Dr. Gilley, that some of you may know, is one of our medical directors as well as some of the IT folks, put together a system using QR codes to allow people with their smartphones to sign up for vaccines and then also to make appointments for vaccines. And that's turned out to be a real key operational aspect of our vaccine success. Next. It was mentioned earlier, I think Dr. Peterson mentioned some of the challenges early on with sequencing. Like Dr. Peterson and Dr. Evans and Dr. Aberfell participated in the statewide vaccine distribution working group and working to come up with sequences for the state. What happened was really that our availability of vaccine vastly outstripped existing recommendations within the state. And so we really early on, we just went with the recommendations of the CDC because we were very, very quickly going through these recommendations and in many of our communities. And as Dr. Peterson mentioned, by January, in many of our communities, we were already vaccinating anyone, regardless of age or risk group. Next. This slide captures our vaccine numbers today. For Mr. Dallas, if you want to speak to that. Maybe you can't see that slide. So today, you know, we have over 11,000 people who have been able to receive the first vaccine, and almost 9,000 have been able to receive the second. And if you go to the next slide, that shows vaccines by communities, in many of our communities, we have been able to vaccinate, we've been able to vaccinate well over 70% of the individuals in the smaller communities, and for many of the larger communities, approaching 50% of the eligible adults. Next. We've been partnering with Manhattan High School, which is a state institution for their eligibles, 16, 17, and 18-year-olds, to get them vaccinated. And that's been well-received. And next slide. Lastly, I think partnerships have been key, and we have been providing vaccine from the IHS, where we have had a very strong support. We've been providing vaccine to communities that do not have a strong IHS presence or necessarily availability of DHS vaccine. This is included the city of Juneau, the city of Ketchikan, Petersburg, Skagway, and just recently, I know Mr. Davis came up and provided a quarter vaccine at the state capitol. We've also, you know, been throughout the pandemic working collaboratively with ESC groups in all of our communities. And I think recently, as we've managed to capture most of the people who are early recipients and acceptors of the vaccine, we're now reaching out with educational and marketing efforts through tribal groups like Lincoln Nevada and Central Tribe of Alaska, but also through media. Madam Chair, that's the end of our presentation.
The time is 10:30 a.m. and this is the first committee that is now adjourned.